They dashed on. Soon a Filipino woman ran up with a tiny baby. She too had seen Andrews in church, wanted him to baptize the baby. By now mildly exasperated, Andrews asked her why she didn't do it herself. She said she wasn't sure how. So he went in another empty house, tried the kitchen faucets, they didn't run, found a bottle of cold water and baptized the baby. The mother burst into tears and ran off. They finally reached Schofield about 8:30. At this point, it was an odd place to go for protection. The planes were gone now. They were finished with this whole area by 8:17, but the post was in enormous confusion. The various anti-aircraft units were trying to get going to their assigned positions, but there were often difficulties. The men in Battery B, 98th Coast Artillery, couldn't get trucks to tow their guns to Wheeler Field until the raid was all over. When they were issued machine gun ammunition, they found it was 1918 stuff, so old the belts came to pieces in the loading machine. With the Japanese likely to return any minute, Private Lester Buckley, back safely from his compost heap, opened the gates of the corral so that at least his mules would have a chance. At Wahiawa, a small town next to Wheeler and Schofield, Mr. and Mrs. Paul Young listened to the explosions nearby. The Youngs were Koreans and ran a small laundry in a shed attached to their house. They had just put in a big night at Mahjong, and Mr. Young was all for staying in bed. But Mrs. Young was curious and finally walked down to the Wheeler gate to find out what was going on. The sentry had a quick answer. "Get back home. Don't you know there's a war on?" Mrs. Young ran back, calling out the news. Mr. Young and his brother, Sung Do Kim, then got up and came down to watch the show. Suddenly they saw a plane flying up the road from Pearl Harbor, looking for something to strafe. Mrs. Young sensed trouble, and they all took cover, except for their old Chinese hired man. He stayed outside, nonchalantly rolling some Bull Durham. The plane got him before he could finish making the cigarette. They ran out and dragged the old man in. Mrs. Young scolded him like a naughty child, asked him why he didn't come inside with them. He replied he couldn't talk because it hurt so much. Now a dogfight began. Stray bullets whined about the house. One smashed a window. Another nicked the washing machine. Another bored a hole through the door where Mrs. Young was peeking out. The family, crouched under the ironing table, caught occasional glimpses of the planes through the skylight. Suddenly there was an ear-splitting roar. A Japanese plane sheared off the top of the eucalyptus tree in their yard, crashed in a pineapple field just beyond. The American fighter that shot it down disappeared off toward the mountains. Mrs. Young, of course, couldn't know it, but Lieutenants Welch and Taylor had reached Haleiwa, taken off in their P-40s, and were now in business. At Haleiwa, 8 miles away, there was now plenty of other action. Two B-17s had lumbered up from the south and were circling above. Captain Chaffin and Major Carmichael had given up trying to land in the shambles at Hickam. After rejecting Wheeler and Ava for the same reasons, they finally decided on Haleiwa, which the Japanese apparently didn't know about. The little strip was only 1,200 feet long, certainly not inviting, but they were almost out of gas and there was no other choice. Down they came, somewhat surprisingly, to perfect landings. They taxied as close as they could to a clump of trees, but already they were too late. A Zero had seen them land and came over to investigate. Somebody yelled a warning, and Major Carmichael and his classmate, Colonel Twaddle, dived under a big rock on the beach. The Zero was probably low in ammunition. He gave Haleiwa a perfunctory burst and flew off. But a Pacific comber took care of Carmichael and his friend. It rolled in, completely drenching them. It even ruined Carmichael's watch. At Kaneohe on the windward side, a strafing Japanese plane cost Ordnanceman Homer Bisbee his watch too, but much more indirectly. As he dived for cover off the seaplane ramp, he noticed he was swimming with his good watch on. At first he held his arm up out of the water. Next he put the watch in his white cap and laid it on the ramp. When he came out from under a few minutes later, the cap was still there, but the watch was missing. Almost anything could have happened to it. The ramp was an inferno. Again and again the dive bombers strafed the 26 PBYs lined up in neat rows, the four others moored in the bay. Several small boats servicing the planes at anchor were riddled too, and one man had to swim all the way across Kaneohe Bay to reach safety. Only one gun was firing back. Chief Aviation Ordnanceman John Finn had mounted a machine gun on an instruction stand far out on the ramp. He hammered away at the strafers in a shower of blazing gasoline from the planes parked around him. A bullet clipped him in the heel, but he kept on firing. The pilots and flight crews struggled to salvage what was left. Ensign C.S. Malwine got a tractor, and with two other men struggled to save a plane that wasn't burning yet. A Japanese fighter swooped down to stop them, and the wing fabric was soon a mass of flames. Another Zero cut down aviation machinist's mate Robert Ballou as he ran out on the ramp with a rifle. Two of his buddies put him on a cot and set off for a truck being used as an ambulance. They were spotted right away. Flat on his back, Ballou watched the tracer bullets smoke by. He found it especially disconcerting when he realized the men had set the cot down and were running for cover. He jumped up and outran them both. At 8:15 a.m., the planes flew off to the north. The quiet was anything but restful. So far there had been no bombing, and everyone sensed that this was what would happen next. Sure enough, around 8:30, Ensign Rees remembered glancing at his watch, 9 horizontal bombers appeared, flying in close formation. Dirt, metal, cement, glass flew in all directions as they dropped their load. Then another formation appeared, but saved their bombs perhaps for a better target. Kaneohe's 2 new hangars were wrecked by now. All was still serene at Bellows Field, the Army's fighter base only 6 miles down the coast. Captain John P. Joyce, the officer of the day, was shaving in the officers' club just before 8:30 when a single plane buzzed the field once, firing about 50 rounds. A private of the medical detachment was hit in bed in the tent area. A messenger drove off to tell Major L.D. Waddington, the base commander, who lived about a mile away, but even this rather startling event didn't seem to stir much excitement. Certainly not enough to keep Private Raymond McBriarty from going to church, as usual, at 8:30. Like everybody else, he hadn't paid much attention to the strafing plane. But then as he sat in the pew with more time to meditate, he began to think how strange it was. Outside, a big B-17 was coming in downwind on the short 2,600-foot strip. Lieutenant Robert Richards was another of the bomber pilots who wanted no part of Hickam. 3 of his crew had been wounded already. So on the tower's advice, he was now trying Bellows. With a damaged plane almost out of gas, he decided to get down as quickly as possible and got away with a downwind landing. At this point, Hickam finally notified Bellows about the attack. Major Waddington hurried on over to get the defense organized, and about the same time, 9 Japanese planes, apparently attracted by Richards's B-17, dropped by and shot up the field. Other enemy planes kept on top of Ava, the Marine Air Base west of Pearl. There were no anti-aircraft guns, no planes that could fly, no chance to do anything. Lieutenant Colonel Larkin, the base commander, watched from under a truck, and most of his men were pinned down just as effectively. Up above, Lieutenant Yoshio Shiga raked Ava with his Zero fighter. He noticed a Marine standing beside a disabled plane and charged down, all guns blazing. The man refused to budge, kept firing with a pistol. Shiga still considers him the bravest American he ever met. Lieutenant Shiga was also impressed by the B-17. He watched one of the big bombers shake off a swarm of Zeros and lumber on safely to Hickam. He made a mental note that in the days ahead, the Flying Fortress was going to be a hard plane to knock out. Perhaps the visitor's biggest surprise was the anti-aircraft fire, which was now coming to life. As Commander Fuchida's 50 horizontal bombers approached Battleship Row in a long single line from the south, they felt they looked entirely too much like ducks in a shooting gallery. If he were doing it again, they would come in some other way. As they neared the target, Fuchida traded positions with the lead bomber in his squadron. This plane had a specially trained bombardier, and when he released his bombs, the other planes would follow suit. All the squadrons operated the same way. Everything depended on perfect timing. When Fuchida saw the third plane in his group get out of line and prematurely drop its bomb, he was thoroughly annoyed. The man had a reputation for carelessness anyhow. Fuchida scribbled, "What happened?" on a small blackboard and waved it at the culprit. The pilot indicated that he had been hit, that the bomb lines had been shot away, and Fuchida was filled with remorse. The squadron flew on. The Nevada was its particular target, and everybody waited for the lead plane to release. It never did. They ran into clouds at the crucial moment and had to try again. Next time around, there was too much smoke over the Nevada, so Fuchida picked the Maryland instead. This time, there was no trouble. The lead plane released and the others followed suit. Fuchida peeked down and felt sure he had 2 hits. Lieutenant Toshio Hashimoto, leading one of the rear squadrons, had an even more difficult time. The backwash of the planes in front kept throwing his group off. Then the lead plane miscalculated its range and signaled the others to hold everything. As they circled for another run, the expert bombardier Sergeant Umezawa bowed his apologies. There were other errors over which the planes had no control. Their map of the area was made in 1933, and the efforts to update it hadn't been too successful. The new Navy tank farm was noted, but a 1936 artist's conception of Hickam had been accepted as gospel, so that the map showed 8 pairs of hangars instead of the 5 actually built. The map also put the underground gasoline system where the baseball field was. At one time, it had indeed been planned for there. Also, the administration building, a vital center, was labeled the Officers' Club and hence not touched. This mistake arose because dances were held there while the permanent club was being built. Whatever the other successes of Japanese agents, apparently they weren't invited to dances at Hickam. But all in all, Fuchida had good reason to be satisfied. As the first attack wave wound up its work around 8:30, he could weigh what had been done to the fleet and the airfields against his own losses. 5 torpedo planes, 1 dive bomber, 3 fighters. Admiral Nagumo was also taking stock of the striking force, now hovering about 200 miles north of Oahu. Brief radio flashes from the planes gave a pretty good picture. 8:05 a.m., torpedoes successfully dropped. 8:10 a.m., 30 planes hit, 23 on fire. 8:16 a.m., large cruiser hit. 8:22 a.m., battleship hit. Once again, everyone went into ecstasy. In the Akagi's engine room, Commander Tanbo's firemen hugged each other with joy as the news filtered down. Up on deck, Seaman Iki Kuramoto shouted in glee. But tough Commander Hoichiro Tsukamoto, navigation officer of the Shokaku, lived in fear of being caught by American planes. He knew the carriers were easy targets. He didn't know how little was left to hit them. Admiral Yamamoto was also serious as he waited for results in the operations room of his flagship Nagato back at Kure. The minutes ticked away on the large nautical clock that hung on the wall. Yamamoto had almost finished his second cigarette when the first word came in. As the results piled up, the rest of the room buzzed with excitement, but Yamamoto rarely changed expression. One intercepted U.S. message spoke of ships operating around the harbor. "Good," exclaimed Rear Admiral Matome Ugaki. "That means our midget subs are getting through." Yamamoto merely nodded. Actually, he still felt the midget submarines were a mistake, that it was a waste of manpower to sacrifice men at the outset of war. He may have been right. Certainly Ensign Sakamaki was getting nowhere. Coming in for another try at the harbor entrance, he got close enough to a patrolling destroyer to see the white uniforms of the crew. It apparently picked him up too, for several depth bombs thoroughly shook up the sub. One of them stunned Sakamaki and filled the sub with fumes and a thin white smoke. When he came to, he withdrew to check his damage. Nothing seriously wrong, so he tried again. According to Sakamaki, he made 3 separate attempts to get by charging depth-bombing American destroyers before ending up briefly on the coral reef just outside the harbor entrance. American memories and records suggest no such spirited engagement. Between the Ward's contact at 6:45 and the time the helm saw the midget on the coral at 8:17, there was only 1 sub-report, the sound contact made by the Ward at 7:03. If Sakamaki was confused or mistaken, it's quite understandable. The air in the sub was vile, the batteries were leaking, the smoke getting worse. And there is certainly no question about one thing he recalls seeing. Once, as he twisted his periscope toward Pearl Harbor, he saw columns of black smoke towering toward the sky. "Look, look," he cried. Seaman Inagaki was completely overjoyed. "Just look at that smoke." They clasped each other's shoulders and solemnly pledged, "We'll do the same."